So hello and welcome to the Talking Locks with Lucky Sweet podcast. My name is Adi Balogun and today with me I have Aaliyah.
Hi everybody.
Well, Aaliyah, it's a pleasure to have you on today's podcast. This is the Chair Convo series and Aaliyah is having a hot oil treatment, which actually gives me the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation, and I'm so excited because the last few episodes I've recorded, I've been, my hands are working, my legs are working, my mouth is working, my brain is working. So today I'm like, oh my God, I'm just going to chill and actually just talk. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. So I usually like to start with how I met some clients, and how I met Aaliyah was quite funny. This was like 2021, almost December, October-ish.
Yes, I think it was August actually.
Oh wow, that
and
late?
I came back in October. Second time I came back in October.
But it was a very beautiful coincidence.
Serendipitous.
Okay, let me you tell the story.
Yes. So I had met a friend of a friend the summer before, so in like June or July the year before. And they had really nice locks. And I was debating whether I should lock my hair before I met them. And so when I met them, I was like, wait, maybe this is a sign. So I was asking questions about where they did it. And she was like, oh, she went to Lockitude in Lagos. And, you know, it was a really great experience. I was like, wow, okay. I'm not going back to Lagos till December. So I'll just do it when I go back. And then I came to visit. At that point, I was living in Atlanta. I came to visit my brother in D.C. In August. And as I was walking around his building, I saw this salon set up. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I can go here and, you know, get some twists or something. And then on the board, I saw Lockitude. And I was like, let me pull up the Instagram this person sends me. I don't know if it can be the same thing. And so I saw it and I was like, oh, wait, it's actually the same thing. So I went and I was like, oh, I was going to go to your store in Nigeria, but since you're here.
Why not?
Can I just get my looks? I was like, this is definitely a sign that I'm supposed to get my looks.
I know. I was so excited. And come to think of it, if it was really August of 21, that was the month I just opened.
Yeah, you told me that. Yeah, I think you had opened like a week or two before. And
we opened August 7th.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah.
You've been with me on this journey, this American journey.
Shout out to my friend for telling me about it.
So. Yeah. So, but we've met and it's been a beautiful friendship since. So we are just going to sit and talk. I think one of the good places to start is relocating. Because shortly after we met, you relocated to the DMV.
Yes.
I had only been in the DMV at the time we met for less than a year. So it was new America for me.
For both of us.
New whole DMV for you.
Yeah.
At the time, I felt like we were both going through our journeys and struggling through it. How do you feel today?
I feel good. I don't think the DMV is going to be my forever home, but I feel like it's working for right now.
Okay.
It's a good place to be right now, so.
What do you miss about Atlanta?
I think because I went to college there, I just have a different, I had a very different experience than to like being here now and working. So in college, it was just like, you can kind of do whatever you want to do, like, at whatever time. And there was not really any questions about anything. But now it's like, okay, regardless of what you're doing, you have to go to work at 9 a.m. the next morning. So, like, you have to be, you know, I had to be a little more strict with myself now. And then I just knew more people in Atlanta. So I had more of a community over there. And yeah, at the time I was in Atlanta, I was closer with my sister than my brother. My brother was living in D.C. at the time. So when I moved to D.C., it was me and my brother, but we weren't really like that close. Now I'm much closer. So when I first moved here, I was just kind of like, ah, I'm here by myself. It's so sad. It's really hard making friends here. But now it's definitely much better.
Easier.
Like, I've met more people.
So I do know that you are in your early 20s. And I should tell you that for me, the experience of leaving my home base at, I think I was 35 when I moved, is probably 10 times harder to meet friends, because you don't have that college opportunity to just meet people.
Yeah.
A lot of the people that you're getting to meet are already settled into their own worlds.
Yeah.
And it's like you're breaking in, they don't really know you, where you come from. And you are, or for me, coming from a country like Nigeria where everybody is in your business, moving to a place where people barely tell you good morning.
Yeah.
Can drive you crazy.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely experienced that when I moved to DC as well. I think also being in college in Atlanta, like, you know the people on your floor, like, you guys see in the common area, stuff like that. So, like, there's more of a sense of community. But here in DC, like, I was living in the same apartment for like a year and I didn't know who my neighbors were. And I would see them in the stairwell and like be like, hi, but that was it.
Oh, they said hi to you? You've got nice neighbors.
But that was it. And I think to an extent for me, it was a little worse that they would just say hi and like, that's it. As opposed to like not even saying anything to me. Because if you're not saying anything to me, I'm like, okay, cool. We're not having a conversation. But if it's just like, hi, bye. I'm like, I don't know. But it's been interesting. I think also coming from Nigeria at 16, I've seen a lot of things in America that I just never really imagined in Nigeria in terms of like how relationships work here, with like friends and community and stuff. And it's been interesting.
Yeah. I think one of the shocking things that happened to me in moving and getting, helping me understand better what America can be like, because I know some parts, people say, I've never been, lived in the south of America, but people tell you that the southern part of America is a little bit more communal than where you start to go up north.
Yeah.
And obviously on the East Coast, we're not that great.
Yes.
But one of the things that struck me as like, oh my God, you are on your own. I had this neighbor in the first apartment I was living in when I moved.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a person I was very curious about. So they were about 6'2". They looked feminine. They had breasts.
Mm.
But they had broad shoulders.
Okay.
And a very slender waist and hips.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, they made up, they looked very good. It could just be, or they could have been a woman who was tall and just had slender hips. Or they could have been transgender, or they could have been anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was in a new place and I didn't know how appropriate it would be to ask.
Mm.
But the Nigerian in me just felt like knocking on their door to say, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
How are you
tell
feeling?
Me about yourself.
Tell me about yourself. What's going on? What made you? Are you? What are you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was itching to have that conversation.
Yeah.
But I had more of a conversation with their dog, Riley, than them. Their name is not even coming to mind right now. But I remember Riley because I would see, they would walk Riley every morning and evening. And somehow I got to know Riley's name was Riley. Mm-hmm. And when I walked past them, I would say, hi, Riley. And I wouldn't even talk to this person. So Riley and I had more of a relationship than they did. They fell sick. And I could tell that they were sick because they were not walking Riley as often. That was the first indicator to me that, something is wrong.
Mm.
So I was concerned because the deck from, you could see we were on the, like, we're above the basement. So we're not really on the ground floor, but you could see your deck from like eye level when you were walking through the building, and the whole deck would be messed up. Riley would have put, nobody cleaned it up, and they were a clean person.
Yeah.
So I was genuinely worried that something's wrong with
the
my
person,
neighbor.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pretend like it wasn't happening. So I called my partner and I was like, I think, because they were traveling.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think something is wrong with Riley's owner.
Mm-hmm.
So they called the police to do a wellness check.
Yeah.
Nobody even said anything to me. I went back to the apartment building. Just the Nigerian that I am. Apparently, that was just too much amiable. But I went back to the apartment building to say, are they okay? Because this is not usual. I even started buying food for Riley and putting food through the deck so that Riley could have some food because Riley would cry all night. I was so worried about this situation. And when I told people at the salon that I'm worried about my neighbor, I've been feeding their dog, and they're like, "You're feeding their dog? What if they sue you? What if the dog..." Yeah. I was just like, "It's a dog." Like, it's obvious that the dog is hungry.
Yeah.
But it was a very... It bothered me a lot. Mm. To cut the long story short, they died.
Mm.
I came home one day and the police was there. I wasn't even sure that they had died. But I was like, "Oh, are they okay?" And the police shook his head and said no. But... Mm. That didn't mean they were dead. So it was a few days later, I kind of heard that they actually did die. And a relative came by to kind of pack their things together, and they put a sign on the building to say, "Hey, Saturday at 9 a.m., come get whatever you want." And Saturday at 9 a.m., everybody was there. And I was like, "What the hell is wrong with these people?"
Yeah.
Riley was crying. Nobody did anything. Yeah. This person was sick. Nobody did anything. Nobody seemed to have cared.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are gone. And I was like, "Oh, this is America."
Yeah.
That really bothered me. That really, really bothered me. But then I just realized that I actually think that the police is your friend, because when it comes to it, the only person who's going to show up is potentially the police.
Yeah, but that's only when somebody calls them to come. they won't just come and look for you just for...
Well, but I would say more recently, I've been here for over 3 years now, and I think I'm getting to find my community.
Mm.
Even through the salon.
Yeah.
Through meeting people like you. Mm-hmm. So my friendships have gone from 1 month of meeting someone in passing and finding you randomly to almost 3 years of having a connection every other month. So I feel a little bit more rooted in the community. I now know where 495 is. I get my way home without looking at GPS. So I think it's getting better.
Yeah. It definitely gets easier. I think at the end of the day, it just depends on what you're looking for. I think most people are looking for community. Most people are looking for safety, well-being. And I think in some places in America, it's easier to find that than others. So you just have to make sure that, like, where you are, what you're looking for, you can find it.
You can find it.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I've not lived anywhere else in the US apart from the DMV environs very specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And even though now I'm in Virginia, I'm still in the DMV part of it. I respect that there are parts of Virginia that are not the DMV.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know what the DMV is, it refers to the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia.
Yeah.
Or the parts of Maryland and Virginia that are around the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I actually do like the DMV. I like that the city is close enough.
Yeah.
And I like that it's quiet enough. Mm-hmm. I like that there's variety. I like that it's diverse. I think because it's close to the seat of power,
mm-hmm.
it also pulls a lot of diversity and different sorts of types of talents. It's expensive, so to live here, but you also have the opportunity to have a higher income.
True.
So I like the DMV. So I've not lived anywhere else, so it might be too soon for me to say, "Oh, I think this is going to be my forever home in America." But I really do like the DMV.
Nice. That's good. I mean, it's very important to like where you live. Me personally, it's not like I hate it, but I don't love it. Like, I could maybe be here for like 2 more years.
You've been ready to leave before you even got
That's
here.
That's actually also very true. But it's really interesting. I think the type of people that I've met here, I think, have been people who have also been looking for a way out. So DC specifically, like, I haven't lived in Maryland or Virginia, but like the District of Columbia is very transient.
Yeah.
It's a very transient city. People come for maybe 2-3 years for work and then leave. People come to start their careers, and then once they get more established, they leave. So that's just kind of the dynamic I've been used to. Or I think when I first moved here, that's what was kind of instilled in me. It was just like, okay, yeah, I'm here for work for maybe max 5 years, and then I'm going to
launch
leave.
A career.
Yeah, launch my career and then leave. So, yeah, and then also I haven't really. I think this also goes into a lot of other things, but relationship-wise, I haven't really met anybody here that I think like, oh wow, maybe I should settle down. I think this might be a crazy thing to say, but the markets that we see here has just been a little. It hasn't been looking too good. And the people my age, like, that are also looking, have not had good experiences as well. So
it might just be the times that we live in right now.
Maybe.
It might just be.
Yeah.
Okay, let's change gears for a little bit. Let's talk about your hair.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to actually lock your hair?
I never really liked taking care of my hair. I have 4C hair, so the whole leave-in conditioner, oil,
cold washing,
it just didn't sit right with me, and I did not enjoy doing it. So maybe in 2019, I kind of started neglecting my hair. Like, I just did twists one time, like really small twists, and I left it for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 months. And I was like, wow, you know, like throughout this whole time, maybe I put oil in my hair, but there was no need to do like a cold wash necessarily. Maybe that was a bad idea. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't hygiene. I'm not sure. But it just felt like less pressure for me to do things to my hair. And then I started wearing my hijab, and I was like, why would I go back to spending 3-4 hours doing my hair on a weekend when I'm just going to cover it and nobody's going to see it? And then I met that friend who had the locks, and I was like, you know what? I think I should do locks. And since I did them, like, I've never regretted doing them. There's nothing I'm really missing that I used to do to my hair before that I'm like, oh, wait, I wish I could do that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think for me, it was just the ease of having them.
22, 23, almost going to be 3 years.
Yes.
At October this year, so 2.5 years in, how do you feel about having locks?
Good.
Did it meet your expectations?
It did. I think it all actually surpassed my expectations, because I was just like, oh yeah, like, I don't have to do too much to my hair. But then also, for me, seeing how much my hair has grown with the locks, I don't think my hair used to grow that much, like, when it was out.
It has really grown, because I haven't seen you for a minute.
Yeah, so when my hair was out, I don't think it was growing as fast or retaining as much hair.
Okay, so here's my thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think generally, if nothing has changed in your lifestyle, your hair was probably growing at the same rates. But when it's locked, you tend to see the length because it's not shrinking as much anymore.
Fair.
So
okay.
That's the, because when it's loose, every time you put water in it, it will shrink. So yeah, it almost feels like, oh, I haven't really grown. But when, and your hair still shrinks when it's locked,
mm-hmm,
but when the locked part of it becomes locked,
yeah,
that part stops shrinking. So you're able to visibly see your length a little bit more.
Fair enough.
So your hair might not necessarily be growing faster.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, my lifestyle did kind of change, because I did start locking my hair after I had graduated from college. I was starting to work in corporates. I don't know, maybe, I think I'm more stressed in corporates than when I was in college. So maybe, yeah, right.
It
maybe
might be
it's
growing
not,
slower.
It might be the opposites, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, it's been a really good experience.
Yeah, so it's interesting that a lot of us do it for almost the same reasons. Because I locked my hair for almost the same reason, where I didn't want to do anything to my hair anymore.
Yeah.
I was actually quite disappointed that I still had to do stuff to my hair after I locked
yes,
it.
Actually,
I was under the impression that I was just going to go to the salon
and just leave it.
Lock it and it will be locked.
Mm.
And they were like, yeah, you need to come back to get it retwisted. I was like, what?
Yeah.
So why?
Yeah.
But no regrets. I've had locks for how many years now? I feel like I've stopped counting. So I started in 2009. So 2019 made it 10 years, 2021, 22, 23, 24. 15 years this November, actually. So that's, wow. I'm never going back.
Yeah.
I think the only thing I might do might be trim my hair, but I'm not going back at all.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about corporate America. So you came to America after secondary school.
Yes.
You did college. Mm-hmm. And then you got into corporate. Brewing.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. So far, so good. It's been interesting, to say the least. I think, at least growing up in Nigeria, there was always a plan for me, right? It was like, you finish secondary school, you get into a good college, you finish college, you get a good job in corporate America, and you're good, you're set. So to my surprise, when I came into corporate America and I still had to, like, grovel a little bit and, like, hustle, like, still have to figure out, like, where I'm trying to go and, like, what I'm trying to do. It wasn't, like, a destination. It was, like, the beginning of another journey. Whereas, and maybe this was just the naive 15-year-old in me being like, oh, yeah, once I get into corporate, like, I'm good. Like, I'm set. But I got into corporate and I was like, oh, there's actually a good number of people in here who don't really know what they're doing. And the veil of, like, how big corporate was or is to everybody that's not in corporate kind of came off. I was like, oh, you guys are actually not that great. Smart, actually. That people who have been working here for, like, 15, 20 years and, like, simple decisions are so hard to make. So it was kind of a letdown, I'll be very honest. After a few months of being in corporate, I was just like, wow, so I'm supposed to do this for the next 40 years? I don't think so.
Interesting.
But obviously, grateful for stability. I'm doing that in air quotes. Stability in air quotes, because anything can happen. Grateful for, like, opportunities to make a decent amount of money and, like, not have to worry about, like, rent and food and stuff. But corporate has all the glitz and glamour, but, like, once you get in, it's, to me, it was kind of like, oh, this is it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So when I think about my career, and I feel like I've had a very long, interesting one over some time now, and I can relate to some of the disappointments of this is all you've been working for, this is all your Nigerian parents have been preparing you for, and then you get there and you're like, am I really going to do this for the rest of my life?
Yeah.
So I can relate to that and understand that. But when I became an entrepreneur, I missed corporate. I had big FOMO. I actually felt like, because I made my own plans, my own decisions, I was in control of how well my business was growing and not growing. I made decisions of when to get out of bed, when to post that Instagram post, when to do a new video or record a new podcast. So that's kind of like, or that was completely all up to me. And I could see, because I ran the salon pretty much as a full-time job for almost 6, going on 7 years.
Okay.
So that's a long time to be a full-time entrepreneur. And I worked in my business. But those 7 years, I always wondered if I was in corporate, what would it look like? And am I giving away or giving up my education and my master's degree and all of this? And I did well in corporate. So so I kind of felt like I was missing out. Now I am back in corporate, but in a whole different context from what I'm used to, because my first corporate life was in Nigeria. So being in corporate in America has been interesting. I think now I'm mature enough to know that nobody knows what they are doing. So that's not really surprising. And I don't think that's the problem of any specific company. I think Agreed. That's just life.
Yeah, I agree.
That we do not know what we are doing. There's a, have you seen Silo? It's a it's a series on Apple TV, maybe.
Haven't seen it.
Yeah. Okay, it's an interesting side talk, but it's an interesting series. But it starts off by saying, we do not know why we're here. And I, when I watched that series, and it's, I think that's one of the first lines.
Yeah.
We do not know why we're here. And I kind of related it to being on Earth. And I was like, well, actually, we really don't even know why we're here. So nobody knows why we're here. We're just all making the best of it. So I think my own expectations when it comes to corporate, I'm actually enjoying corporate America. I'm enjoying entrepreneurship. I am enjoying the hustle and bustle. Yeah. But I think I'm burning the candle.
Yeah, two ends.
And the middle.
And the middle. The whole candle is being burnt right now.
The whole candle is being burnt, so.
Interesting. I think for me, the shock was more so from, at least in Nigeria, adults are these high and mighty beings who know almost everything. I can tell you exactly what to do at every point in time. And so being, well, being, so I started in corporate America when I was 20. I turned 21 like a few days or maybe a week after I started. And I was like, all of a sudden I was like in the same space as all these like
adults
older,
older people who are supposed
to know everything. And that was not the case. Well, so I was, I think I was just shocked because I was programmed to think that like adults just know everything. And I mean, now that I'm getting older, I'm realizing that, like you said, nobody really knows 100% what they're doing. I feel like you make decisions day to day, but in terms of long-term plan and, like, having a having everything drawn up and thought out,
nobody is there. We have no idea.
Yeah.
So that brings me to, like, I think you just got to do what your mind tells you to do, how you feel, because we all have different paths, different journeys. You just have to go with your flow.
And
if there's anything I can give myself a little bit of credit for, I have gone with the flow a lot in most of my life.
Fair enough.
And
I
no regrets.
Yeah.
There have been hard times. It's not all been
roses.
Yes. There are times where I can cry. Trust me. There are times where I'm like, what am I doing with my whole life?
Yeah.
But just looking back so far, today I'm in a good place and I'm grateful.
Nice. Yeah. Gratitude always. Contentment. Very important.
Yeah, I know that you do some diversity and inclusion work at work.
Yes.
What does that really mean? Is it even important? Is there why are we acknowledging like we are diverse so?
Yes. That's a loaded question. Is it even important? It's I think the work is important. I think what's even more important is how we do the work. I think that the whole premise and the beginning of diversity is to be like, okay, yeah, we all have different needs based on like where we're coming from in life. And sometimes that has to do with like your race. It has to do with like your ability, so if you have a disability versus not having a disability, visible, non-visible, language barriers, like all these things play into where your starting point in life kind of is, right? And I think the whole reasoning or premise behind diversity, equity, and inclusion is to make sure that people from all these communities who need different things can get all the different things they need to kind of get to the same point at the top. That's the premise.
Okay.
Does it always happen like that? No.
I don't even think life is designed to happen like that. Like the famous saying, all fingers are not equal.
Yeah.
So even if everybody had the same starting points, we all know we're not going to get to the finish line at the same time.
Yeah. So it's not even, and I think in America specifically, there is this I don't know if I should say it's an idea, but there's this understanding that a certain group kind of made it harder for everybody else to get to where they need to be, basically. Now, is that 100% true? Is that 100% factual all the time? I don't think so, but that's kind of the understanding that everybody in DEI, or most people in diversity, equity, and inclusion are starting from, right? And I think that's also changing now with, like, politics and policies where they're like, oh, actually, you can't say this specific program is just for one group.
Okay.
So, for example, there were a lot of things with, like, some universities where they were like, oh, you can't have specific, like, scholarships for Black students. You have to say the scholarship is open to everybody. And if you happen to pick a Black student, that's great. If you happen to pick somebody that's not Black, then so be it. Like, that person should get it too.
Because it feels like the diversity, what's the second one?
Equity.
Equity. I was going to say exclusion and inclusion. Equity and inclusion sometimes can actually create diversity, inequity, and
Not inclusion. Yeah. So I think it's tricky, which is why I said, like, the way you do it is more important than, like, doing it at all, because there has been some feedback generally that, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion is not actually helpful. You bring all these programs and you have programs that, like, bring diverse people into your company, into your school, but they still face, like, not feeling included because now they've gotten into a really good school, but they're the only Black person in that class, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're the only Asian in that class, and they feel like they don't get a good experience because everybody around them feels like, first of all, they shouldn't even be there.
They shouldn't be there. Right? They're only there because of
this scholarship program. Or because of this program. And so there's a lot of, like, backlash with things like that. There's a lot of misunderstanding of, like, what the finish line with diversity, equity, and inclusion is. Is there a finish line? Is there ever going to be a point where we get to and we're like, oh, actually, yeah, the whole world is very integrated. We don't need to do DEI anymore, you know? So I know you asked how that looks like for me, but basically what I do in work is I help communicate about programs about different diverse groups, basically. I do a lot of email writing. I do a lot of, like, internal events for employees and stuff.
You know, in many ways, I can see how it is helpful, because through programs like that, people who would potentially never have had the opportunity have found themselves in different spaces.
Yeah.
And I can also tell that, like, including one person actually starts to help you include the whole group.
Yes.
So when I joined the corporate organization that I work with now, it was summer of 22, and they had all the summer programs. So I met the only other Nigerian guy that works in the building. And he was very happy to meet me. I was literally introducing myself. So this was kind of the first time everybody was getting together post-COVID.
Yeah.
So there were people who had been employed in the last 2 years before I even got in, who had been working for, you know, 2 years plus, who had never met each other in person. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of people just meeting each other for the first time.
Yeah.
It just so happened to be my first week in the company. And I was introducing myself to somebody else. And when he heard my name, he's like, Adi, you are Nigerian. And I was like, So I was like, oh my God. And he was like, yeah, thank God I'm the only other Nigerian here. And since then, the Nigerian pool has started growing a little bit. Nice. Because I feel like it's just natural.
Yeah.
And when there are other groups in the company, and sometimes you see teams where the race dynamics are almost the same, and that's potentially because there was an opening and you know somebody within your demographic, so it starts to include more people into spaces that they otherwise probably wouldn't have been if there was no attention to diversity. However, I feel that sometimes coming from a place of understanding the privilege of being the majority, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
Because as a Yoruba girl who grew up in Lagos, where everybody around you speaks same thing, where your name sometimes can open doors for you even if you know nobody in the room.
Yeah.
And those are privileges that you have just because they exist. So should anybody really be penalized for having privilege?
Nope. So I think that's another thing that comes up a lot with DEI, is that like people are trying to punish the white man or white woman for just having privileges, or like they have some things that, you know, life just kind of handed to them on a silver platter and now everybody's upset about it. There's some people, don't get me wrong, that are upset that there are white people who are getting things that, quote unquote, they don't deserve, but they just happen to have. And I think for a lot of people who do DEI work, it's less about trying to take away the privilege, but trying to get people to use that privilege to do more for other people, which is also not like by force. It shouldn't be by force. The same way, like, I know a lot of people are like, oh yeah, there's so many billionaires in the world, and if they just give money to people in Africa, like, maybe Africa won't be as poor as it is. You can't force people to give money that they worked hard for just to like random people, just because you think it's the right thing to do. Like, I feel like if for some people, if based on their religion or based on like their culture, there's that idea of giving back and like trying to help the whole world, then yeah, sure. But I can't put a gun to Bill Gates' head and tell him, oh, you have to give money to people in Africa.
If you ask me, I actually think he's doing so much. Like, he has a different agenda. Why are you giving back so much? What do you really want?
And that's the thing. I think people just have this idea that like people in DEI are trying to take away all the privilege of the white people, are trying to get everybody like on the same level right now. But it's a thing of like, if you have, and I think it's more of a moral issue than like I'm doing this thing because I want to be a good person, as opposed to like, I should be forced to do this thing, you know? And so it's like, oh yeah, like if you really want to be a good person, go and help some people in Flint, Michigan who don't have water, and, you know, maybe help the people and their family to get out of that place, as opposed to like
trying to direct it towards a race.
Yeah, trying to make sure that like, oh, say, oh yeah, we're going to help the black community, or like this white person has to give all his money to black people. Like, obviously we know that ancestors did things, but I don't think that should be a reason for them to now be like, oh yeah, I have to give,
I'm indebted to this race, or I have to go and adopt a black child.
Exactly. So it's, and I think that's why the work now is becoming so murky. It's like, okay, you're working in DEI, does that mean you hate white people? No. Or you're working in DEI, does that mean that like you want to put people in places that they don't really deserve to be in just so there's some diversity?
Yeah, I think sometimes it hurts because I would love, so for somebody like me who now works in corporate America, I never want to be in the room because of my race.
Yeah.
I want to be in the room because I deserve to be in the room.
Because I know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
You know. So, and there are many times at work where I am the only black person in the room. However, I don't know what the motives of the company that employed me is. I do not know if I was a diversity hire. I don't feel like a diversity hire, you know, but I don't know if that's their motive.
Yeah.
But every day I show up and I put good work in.
Yeah.
To make sure that I am advancing, I am learning, I am progressing, I'm helpful. And having grown up in a country like Nigeria, it's very difficult for, it's easy for the nuances of racism to be lost on me.
Yeah.
because there are foolish people everywhere in the world.
Yes.
And people will do things to you regardless of your tribe, your race, yes, your color, yeah, your social class. Mm-hmm. You know, you have people tell you things like, I have your type at home.
Yeah.
In Nigeria.
Yeah.
Or people are ageist, sexist. It happens all the time.
Everywhere, so, yeah.
When I encounter people who choose to be foolish, I'm like, you're just foolish.
Yeah, it's not by your race. So
and that's not the first thing that comes to me. Although, with time, it's usually in hindsight. I'm like, oh, was that
racism?
Was that racism? Yeah. I was like, and I'm still not even sure. Because there's so much nuance around it.
Yeah.
But I would say that I know that two things can be true at the same time.
1,000%.
So,
yeah.
Two opposing things can be true at the same time. Yes. So, yes, there is racism. Yes, there is, like, victimhood from racism where there is somebody who is racist and there is somebody who turns everything to, is it because I'm black?
Yeah.
So,
And I think that's why it's so tricky now. Oh, I think it's always been tricky with diversity, equity, and inclusion because they're always, and maybe this is with everything in life, there's always people on the other side that are like, you guys are just doing this thing just for show. Like, it's just so people can say that your company is not racist. You're, like, having all these programs just to bring more people in. But I think at the core, again, of diversity, equity, and inclusion is just to, like, make sure, one, there's people from different backgrounds. Because I think generally just companies that are more diverse do better. Just generally. Like, if you have a team with
more perspectives.
They're more perspectives. They're more, like, understandings of ways to solve different problems. So, and then equity is also like, well, okay, you guys don't all need the same thing, right? You guys all need different things to get to the same place eventually at some point. And then, if you come into this place and you're the only person, is there a sense of inclusion? Like, nobody looks like you in that room, but do they make you feel like, yeah, truly, you're the only person that doesn't look like us? Or is there a sense of like, oh, yeah, like, we don't look alike, but we're here to solve the same issue and it's fine.
Yeah. You know?
So, yeah.
Wow.
DEI is a lot.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, fasting just finished recently. How was it?
It was good.
You know, I attempted to fast. What year was that? I think it was the year 2022.
Yeah, I think it was 2022.
Yeah, I did 15 days.
Yeah? That was more than a good number of people, actually.
I did 15 days. I
was actually so proud. I was like, oh my God.
And this year, I was like, yeah, I'm so definitely going to do it. And the lady who sits next to me at work is Muslim. And I think on the first day of fasting, I was like, hey, do you want to go to lunch? And she was like, fasting. I was like, oh, it's today. It was so funny.
You say it's started.
And I was like, I don't think I'm going to do it, you guys, this year.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try again. I've always been fascinated. I don't know if fascination is the right word, but I have been, my religious views are very fluid in the sense that my mom is Christian, my dad was born Muslim, ended up switching to traditional Yoruba religions before he died. So if there's diversity,
in your household,
so that's that. But I've always kind of and that's an interesting question I have to ask. I've always been fascinated by the fact that Muslims fast according to the rhythm of the world. Like the sun rising and setting.
Yeah.
The moon cycle. So it just makes me feel like you're grounded into something. As opposed to in Christianity where a pastor calls a fast for a particular time. Or the Catholics, for instance, the Easter doesn't necessarily has its own science to when it happens, but doesn't necessarily follow like our environment. So that's always been a trip, and I think that's my attraction to attempting
the
Islamic Ramadan. And the next one is going to be
it'll probably start in
the sun's
going to
be rising February? So it's going backwards?
Yeah. So it goes back,
Okay, so
last year it started in maybe early April or mid-April. This year it started like mid-March.
Oh, okay. So that'll be better because it'll be getting that faster.
Yeah. That's the... Yeah. But you asked how it was for me this year. It was really good. I feel like every Ramadan I learn more about myself on the journey to learning more about the religion, which is very helpful. There's always this like larger sense of community during Ramadan as well, because people like break that fast together. You're spending so much time like in the mosque, and it just feels like all of us are going to the same place together, and it doesn't necessarily feel like that year round. So it's always a nice feeling. Nice feeling.
You told me about some iftar place that you go and break your fast in Maryland and all of that.
Yeah.
Even if it's for anything, that it was a mala.
Yeah, so there's it's called the Nigerian Muslim Council. There's like a mosque. It's run by Nigerians. I mean, it's open to anybody, like most religious spaces. But it's run by Nigerians. They have iftars every day. And I would always go there to get my amala and abula.
Okay.
Like routine.
What did you call it? The Nigerian
Muslim Council.
Muslim Council.
It's in Brentwood, Maryland.
Okay. I'm just, the reason I asked that, one of my previous clients today was asking where he, if he wanted to intentionally hire from the Nigerian community, like what would be a good place? And I had suggested like a church. Like
yeah.
I know the Jesus House Baltimore is kind of popular.
Popular for Nigerians.
For Nigerians and the DMV. So I might mention that to him from the Islamic side, because I know the religious places are like the number one community that you can find here. So the other question I was going to ask, I traveled recently and I was talking to a Muslim. I was Northern Europe. And I was like saying that you have to face the east to pray as a Muslim. And it corrected me and said, no, you actually have to face Mecca.
Yes. So it's not east or west. It just depends on where you are in the world. But it's towards Mecca. So every Muslim is supposed to face towards Mecca when they're praying.
I thought you were facing the rising sun for the life of me. Because I feel so that it means when you're in Nigeria, Mecca is the east.
I'm not too good at geography, I won't lie. But I think when you're in Nigeria, it's more like maybe northeast-ish, like slightly. And then here, it's east. I think if you're in some parts, if not most parts of Europe,
you might be going a little bit south.
Yeah, so. Like southwest or something.
I was like, oh, you just face the sun, right? And they're like, no, you face Mecca. I was like, are you kidding me? My whole life, I would have to, if any Muslim man asked me, where am I supposed to face? I was like, yeah, the sun rises right there. My geography is quite good, so I usually know where the sun is rising.
Yeah.
Just face east. It's right there.
Yeah, I think at least for, like, being in America, for the most part, it's towards where the sun is rising, too, because the sun rises in the east.
That's interesting. So what is dating like for... That was funny. I haven't finished the question that you're like...
finished the question. Let me not drop the gun.
So what is... Okay, so two sides to the question. Mm-hmm. So being in your early 20s and you... I kind of consider you like the internet generation. Gen Z, by the way. I went to Aaliyah's... last birthday party, and I felt so honored to be invited for a Gen Z party because I am a vintage millennial, and I felt like I did good until she called me Miss Adi, I almost died.
Guys, I was saying I was having an internal battle. Seriously, I was like, I know that every time I talk to her, I say Adi, but I was like, my mom was in my ear, like, you have to say Miss. If you don't say Miss.
I was doing so well. I was blending in the lingo and everything. Yeah. And then she just said Miss Ade. And I just felt like her primary school teacher.
No, but after you gave your it wasn't a speech, but the words about me, I think everybody was like, oh yeah, she's cool.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. All right. I'm still cool, Gen Z.
Yeah.
So I was going to say two sides to the question,
yes.
Right? So... being a Gen Z, do people even meet people in real life, or is dating now like 101% app dependent? That's one side of the question.
Yes.
I was saying before we started recording that when oftentimes, like in the Nigerian setting, when you think about dating, you want to go to a wedding, mm-hmm. you want to go to church, you never know who you might meet.
Yeah.
So is the Islamic world kind of similar? Are there avenues where you're intentionally like showing up to religious events to potentially meet somebody?
Okay, so the first part of the question, is everything online? No. I think also from like just generally a Muslim perspective, there's some apps that are supposed to be helpful. But honestly, all the women I know that are on those apps are not having a good time and have not really found anything. I don't know how the men are doing. I don't really know any men that are on there, to be honest. I think people are still hoping and believing that they will find somebody in person through like a natural meeting.
Interaction.
People that I know don't necessarily go to the mosque to like find a partner. I think also because like in mosque, men and women are separated. So like you don't really have that opportunity to like properly interact or like talk to somebody about like getting to know them further. Doesn't mean you can't meet them right outside the mosque and just be like, hey, bye, like what's happening? I think people look to like third spaces. So there's this Islamic community center that I started going to it's not a mosque, but most people that go there, if not maybe 97% of people that go there are Muslim. Right. And so they have like programming, they have like events and stuff. And so people can meet there and just kind of have like natural conversation. And if they want to get married, they can. If they want to get to know each other more, they can. So third spaces like that. People also meet at weddings. I think friends of friends are always a good way to meet people.
Have you ever tried the apps?
I have. It was not a good experience. It's really interesting because I think this one specific interaction that I remember, I think I was maybe 21 or maybe 22, and I was on the app, and me and this guy matched, and we started talking, and it was like cool. I was like, okay, cool. Like, we're talking for maybe like a week, maybe two, and he was like, oh, I'm Christian.
Uh-oh.
By the way. And I was like,
Uh-oh.
I was like, what are you doing here? What? I don't understand. Because the app specifically is like, I don't think they can ask you like
if you're
Muslim or Christian or if you're religious, but like it's specifically designed for Muslim people to find spouses. And so I was like, okay, well, there's nothing we're doing here because I'm not going to get married to someone who's not a Muslim. And he was just like, oh, you know, he'll be willing to convert for me. I was like, bro, you don't even know me. Why would you say that?
That's interesting.
It was a really weird experience for me because
catfishing.
I was just like, why, how did we get here? And why did we get here? But yeah, so the apps haven't really been helpful for me. Like, there was one guy that I spoke to for a while. And we ended up becoming friends. But that was not my husband. And I knew from maybe, like, 6-7 months in. I was just like, yeah, there's not really anything that we're doing here. But he was a cool guy. So I was like, who knows? Maybe he could be my friend's husband. Maybe mutual somewhere, so... But yeah, the apps are interesting.
Yeah, I think that is interesting all around. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
So one of my other clients, Kayla, was talking to me about some apps that actually bring you in person.
Mm.
Yeah, so she was talking about events. I have to listen to that episode again to remember exactly what we talked about. But she had talked about two different type of events. I think one, she could remember the name, but it happened. And I think they tried to even the number of the gender of the people who come to the event so that the women don't overly outweigh
they usually do.
But I thought it was an interesting
Interesting
concept.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Muslims can meet people anywhere, really.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, that they want to, like, get to know further. Yeah, I think it's very...
So, let's kind of change gears on this conversation. I know we've talked a lot about work. We've talked about dating a little bit. We've talked about iftar. Oh, man, I miss that Amalao. I feel like next year, you still have to be in the DMV. I need to at least go and eat some...
Like, those grease. some
after-fasting food.
Yeah.
How has being a young adult...
Hmm.
And I know you kind of are disappointed in all of us adults.
Not necessarily, but...
You're like, yeah. You guys didn't meet the whole expectation of being an adult. But now you're an adult yourself.
Yeah.
And how has adulting been so far?
It's been good, actually. I think... For me, the ability to, like... make my own decisions and, like, stand by them and kind of do what I want to do, for lack of better words, has been really empowering, because I'm also, like, whatever decisions I make, I have to stand by them. I can't be like, oh, yeah, my mom told me to do that, so that's why I did it, and whatever happens, I'll blame it on my mom, because I can't. It's been also a little nerve-wracking, because I'm like, whatever I do, I have to own it. So it's both like a blessing and a curse in my eyes, because I'm like, I really have to be very thoughtful about the decisions I make. And I mean, you can always start over whenever you want, but you just have to be very careful, very thoughtful, very introspective, of like everything that you do.
Well, that's a good place to start. I'll just say, don't put too much pressure on yourself.
Mm.
Don't forget to live life while you are adulting as well.
Yeah.
Don't forget to live life. I know that you have a podcast which may evolve.
Yes.
And what was that podcast about?
So it was called On Coming to America, and me and my co-host, Esther, we used to talk about basically the immigrant experience in America, usually for people who had just come from whatever country to America for college. And so we would talk about kind of things that we learned throughout our college experience. We had some people who we would like speak to about, you know, after college life, what they were doing in college, just to, like, inspire people.
You had
people.
Guests on the podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just to inspire people that would listen to the podcast and just be like, yeah, man, we're all starting together. We're all going to figure this out together. And, you know, building a sense of community for people who had just left their whole community in a different country.
But have you thought about the offshoots of that going forward, or has life gotten to... to you?
I think life has gotten to both of us. But I think if we do go back, it would definitely be something similar, but less about college experience and more so about, like, because both of us are in corporate right now. So it might be something about corporate or just like outside college, after college.
Life
or something
after
like
college.
That.
Adulting.
Full stop.
So Aaliyah has a double nose piercing, which I find fascinating. I love piercings.
Yeah.
I don't know if you all have like nine on one ear.
Yeah.
And like three, I exaggerate, maybe six on one ear and then three on the other ear. But I've been so terrified about piercing my face.
Mm.
And I don't know if my nose is that cute to actually have a nose piercing.
Oh.
But usually it's one most people get.
Yes.
And I think you explained to me that this was a Gen Z thing. Or no?
Not necessarily. I think it's interesting that you bring that up, because just this Ramadan, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a mosque and this older woman was just, like, we were about to pray and this older woman was just looking at me and I was like, I don't know why she's looking at me like that. Am I looking okay? And she was looking at my face, like, very intensely. And then she was like, oh, come. And so I went to meet her and she was just like, ah, you have 2 piercings. Wow. When did you decide to do that? And I was like, oh, you know, I did it maybe 2 years ago now. And she was just like, wow. Ah, and your parents didn't say anything about it.
Is she Nigerian?
She is Nigerian. And I didn't want to say that she was Nigerian, so they would think that, you know, that's how all Nigerians are. But she was like, your parents didn't say anything about it. I was like, no. My mom was actually the one that got the jewelry for me. And my dad said I look cute. So, and she was just like, ah, okay. And then it was just like silence. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to go back now. Thank you. I don't think it's a Gen Z thing. For me, I started off with one. I think maybe 2020 was when I got my first one. And it was cute. So I was like, oh, this is cool. But like 80% of the young Muslim girls I know have one nose piercing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not trying to be like all the other girls, you know? I want to be different. And so I got my second one.
But did you ever consider, what's the one septum? Called? Yes.
I did not consider it. I have a friend who got one around the time I was getting my second one. And I just don't think my nose is the shape for a septum.
Right.
So I was just like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. So I got my second one. And I was like, wait, this is so cute. And every time someone would see it, they're like, wow, I've never seen someone with 2. I'm like, thank you.
Yeah.
That was kind of the point. And then, well, nobody can see. You can see the jewelry on my nose. But it used to be like small silver balls. That was the jewelry on it before. And then my mom went and she got me these ones. That they're like floral diamond-ish. Yep. Yeah. And
from afar, they actually look like a small butterfly.
Ah, okay. See, I don't know. But maybe that's why people are so intrigued sometimes. But
like you have to tell you cute butterflies.
My mom got me this jewelry and ever since, like whenever I meet someone, they're just like, wow, those are really cute. And I'm like, thank you.
They're different. I know I've seen a few people with the double nose piercings, but not as many as the single. But yes, I think that's a real... It's very common.
Very common, yeah.
Muslim community to have that.
Yeah. And I think also I noticed that people would have one stud and one hoop for people who had 2. And I tried it. I didn't really like the look, to be honest. So I was just like, yeah, let me stick to my 2 studs.
Would you get tattoos?
No. So Islamically, you actually are not...
allowed to mark your body.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Did I know that? I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
I really don't think I knew that. Well, we've had a fantastic conversation so far. And look at us, it's been over 1 hour.
Oof.
And I feel like today I've got to put my legs up and actually be in the chair myself while we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
But Aliyah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like I'm going to end this recording and I'm going to remember something that I wanted to talk to you about. I feel through this conversation, there's something has been coming to my head and like, just dancing around,
dancing around.
Let me see if I can search my brain for it. I don't know. I could just click record again if I remember. After we've ended the podcast. But it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I find you a very young, smart, charismatic woman. Yes. I think you're going to do great things in the world. And I'm not just saying that to like for the podcast. I genuinely feel that way.
Thank you.
I genuinely feel that way. It's always a pleasure. I'm happy you came out all the way on the Silver Line.
Me too.
To Ashburn, Virginia, to come make your hair.
Yeah.
And always a great conversation.
Thanks. And you too. I feel like every time we talk, you treat me like an adult. Which I feel like lots of adults in my life don't really treat me like an adult. I think also being the last child and, you know, being around older people from a young age.
That's interesting because I feel personally that age is just a number. And even though I have step siblings, we did not grow up together.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up as an only child. So I feel when you grow up as an only child, people often treat you as an adult very early. So it's I don't have I've tried not to say anything about kids yet because my producer has said, like, in the last four episodes,
you said about kids?
Kids. I'm always talking about babies. Ooh, feel like to have a baby.
Is that a
baby?
Are you trying to?
So, anyway, I've just brought up kids again. I don't have kids yet, but I find it very difficult to actually treat kids like children.
Yeah.
Because I want them to talk to me. I want them to use their words. Yeah. I feel like they are reasonable people, but I think age is really, really just a number. And yeah. I think the older you get, the more you realize that you can be 40 and completely stupid.
Yes.
And you can be 15 and be really, like, grounded and wise.
I see it every day at work. Yep.
Well, I really do hope the best for you going forward.
Thank
and
you.
All the good things that life has to offer come to you. So
thank
we
you
have
for
to continue
me.
This hot oil treatment. Like, your hair has really absorbed a lot of
I'm hoping
moisture.
Yeah.
And so let's get rinse some of that product out of your hair. And for those of you listening out there, this has been the Talking Locks with Locky podcast. It's been fun talking to Aliya. My name remains Ade Balogun, and you can listen to us wherever you listen to your podcast. There will be more cheerful conversation coming your way. And as always, don't forget to keep it locked with an attitude. Bye.
Bye.